and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann. I'm the editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by Stephen Wilmot, Companies Editor. How are you doing, Stephen?
Very well, John.
Good. Bradley Gerard, how are you?
I'm very good. I go on holiday after today, so I'm in tip-top mood.
Good. Glad to hear it. Where are you going? Here we're nice.
Home for a week and then Fuerteventura.
Lovely. Lovely. Bit of sun.
Yeah.
Graham, over to control room. How are you doing, Graham?
Hello, John. Very well.
Good. Good. So, an exciting week this week. Certainly in the news section, obviously we have had an enormous revelation, a big scandal brewing over in Germany, Volkswagen. So we'll come on to that in a minute. We're going to talk about the cover feature, which Stephen, you kind of coordinated this week, which is about Generation Z or Millennials and Generation Z. So how the youth and their changing habits are affecting the way we look at some of the companies we cover. Okay, well, I mean, we may as well go back to the news section and Volkswagen. And actually, Stephen, as you pointed out earlier, we've got a bit of a car-themed results section this week as well.
Absolutely. AA, one of the larger companies that have reported last week.
Yeah, so driving. Who could have thought that a scandal, potentially on the scale of the banking scandal that we've had over the past few years, could have emerged from something as humble as the automobile? But it seems to be heading that way. Bradley,
yeah, it
what's
does.
Going
I mean,
on?
Well, yeah, as you say, it's a big scandal which quickly engulfed the chief executive of Volkswagen, who decided to resign
with a little bit of hesitation.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I guess he's probably a bit annoyed that this scandal started in the US. Although just before I came down, it does seem actually that there seem to be reports out of Germany that emissions tests are also potentially cheated in Europe too. So yeah, it's going from bad to worse. I mean, we were kind of talking upstairs about, well, as you say, it's potentially a very big crisis, and it's hard to maybe call the bottom of this, because while a large slug of the market cap has come off the company, you just don't know how far this is going to roll.
23 billion euros. I just made the calculation just before coming down.
Yeah, so Monday, Tuesday, when this story started to break, I think over the 2 days it was down about 40%, and then it bounced back on Wednesday. So I guess a lot of people thought, well, this, you know, is containable.
It bounced back marginally. I mean, I think that the issue is that, so in the US there's a body called the EPA, and they're not afraid of fining people.
Yeah, so that's the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, it is. I've spoken to a few fund managers about their view on VW managers that hold it. And I suppose one thing to say is that, although it sounds a bit bleak, Volkswagen hasn't killed anyone, which, you know, actually GM did with its ignition fault and got fined not as much as people originally.
I'm going to have to pick you up on that, right, for a couple of reasons. So one, neither did the banks, but we didn't hesitate to massively fine them. Pollution is a big issue. Mm. Diesel cars were already under the spotlight for the environmental damage that they do. Car pollution is thought to be a big killer. You know, not easy to measure, but it is thought to be a big killer. And gaming emissions tests on this scale is producing a lot more pollution than they're admitting to in the first place. It could actually have killed people. The health implications should not be dismissed. And my point of view is that's why I don't think they'll get away with this lightly. And that's why the EPA are interested as well.
And on the, I kind of agree with that view, but just a couple of fund managers I have spoken to, they literally said those words. They haven't actually killed anyone.
I just don't agree with it.
Well, that's fine. But it does kind of come back to the point that while there are these massive numbers of like a potential $18 billion fine being imposed, it just seems a fine of that scale is very unlikely to happen. I mean, in the US, obviously, you've got a lot of lobbies. There is probably a very powerful motor lobby that will be very keen to protect the interests of... Although Volkswagen's a small part of the market share in the US, they'll be keen to protect the industry.
Of course they will. So in the UK, the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders came out very quickly and said, you know, any speculation that this may be an industry-wide problem is wide of the mark. You know, it's a problem with the emissions testing process in Europe and it needs changing. So a lot of people have said that, but, of course the industry, the lobbies are going to come out and say this is not a wide-scale problem. But we've known for years that the kind of efficiency, miles per gallon, emission stuff you see on the specs when you buy a car are nowhere near what you get in reality. And you know, perhaps people are starting to join the dots and say, hang on a minute.
I think so. And there are a few more bearish points that the fund managers did point out. Like Giles Worthington at Smith & Williamson, who I spoke to, did point to the fact that, okay, we're probably likely to see increased regulation, at least, if not legislation, in some of the countries involved here. There's potential for an increase in R&D spend for car companies, because if they're catalytic converters aren't actually doing the work they're supposed to, if they're having
well, they can't. The catalytic converter is not what creates the emissions, it's what deals with them. So I guess
whichever way you kind of the thing that either creates it or the thing that deals with it, that must potentially have to be improved if we're in a situation where a major car company had to use additional technology to make it meet standards. Yeah. So from whichever end you come at the emissions thing, there probably is likely to be an increase in spend for car manufacturers, potentially, is one manager's view.
Okay, so you know, taking that a step forward in terms of our thinking about how this might impact the stock market. Mm. So forget about Volkswagen. I suspect not a huge number of our readers will actually hold that, although they may hold it indirectly in European funds if they hold them. But for the UK car industry, potentially quite good news, because actually what we're good at is supplying the components that make these things, that potentially will clean up these cars, that will provide the R&D expertise.
Well, Ricardo is the obvious company to single out there. Yeah. They've been doing environmental car technology for years, so who knows, they could see a benefit as some of this extra R&D spending goes to Ricardo. I mean, the obvious victim of this in the UK is Johnson Matthey, which makes catalytic converters, and that's a big part of its profits.
Mm.
I think I read about half of its profits, and the diesel ones are particularly lucrative, and I understand that one of the hopes driving that stock had been that diesel would gain more market share in the US. But obviously that doesn't look like it's going to be the case now.
No, and I mean, this is an interesting thing about the European car industry. It's very heavily skewed towards diesel cars and diesel technology. And as I said at the beginning of this podcast, you know, diesel had already, there were already question marks about it. So as readers and listeners may have heard ad nauseum, I bought a new car this year. And we looked at, you know, shall we go diesel, shall we go petrol? And, you know, just doing a bit of research, which I'm inclined to do to the nth degree when I'm buying anything, no matter how cheap it is or how small. You know, I started to worry about diesel. It seems my fears were not entirely unjust. You had the same thoughts, didn't you, Graham?
Yeah, we looked at diesel because, you know, from the figures in the book, miles per gallon, they look efficient. It looks like you'll save money on fuel costs.
Yeah.
But maybe not.
Yeah, yeah. So I've been saying the big worry is that, I mean, this but is a huge blow for the European car industry as a whole because of the investment that's been made in diesel. And you know, one of the things that the European car industry has been quite successful in doing, perhaps in a way that the American car industry is not, is going into China.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, that's true. I mean, the VW thing has brought other sort of stocks down. One thing that is actually interesting, again, to mention Giles Worthington at Smith & Williamson, he actually had VW as his top holding just a couple of months ago. But
ouch.
He had actually halved it before this scandal. Not because obviously he knew what was coming, but because he was fearful about the ability of VW to leverage sales into China. He was worried about the Chinese economy. And obviously that was a big catalyst for him buying the stock initially, became a bit more bearish.
The shares
on that
have
profit.
Been weakening for, you know, since the spring.
But that's the China economy thing.
Because of the China angle. Yeah. So actually, but they have been very successful, European car manufacturers, in gaining market share in China. But the economy there has led to a paring back of that story recently.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. You know, you say that the fine of 18 billion seems perhaps a little bit fanciful. But, you know, I read this morning as I was reading around the story that UK lawyers have been deluged by calls from diesel, you know, VW diesel car owners wondering what their position is. Because, think about, if you've bought a diesel car on the basis that it's cleaner and drives further, and suddenly you find out that it doesn't, and you've been lied to in your marketing. There are potentially huge class action lawsuits.
It does seem like there are very open-ended liabilities, which I think is why it's worth exploring the parallel with BP, which is the other company that, you know, another company that had an environmental disaster with the potential for massive open-ended liabilities.
Yeah.
And I was looking at the BP share price graph. And the thing is, if you, forgetting this year, which obviously the past year and the weakening oil price has obviously massively hit BP's shares, which are now at 324p. But in 2010, they plunged from about 650p to 300p in a few months. And if you'd bought at the bottom, then you'd have made money. So there was obviously the same camp at the time of the Deepwater Horizon, which said, oh no, it's a great opportunity to buy into BP. But the problem was, it wasn't obvious where the bottom was. So there were plenty of falls. I mean, just as we're seeing with VW, you know, is this the end? Or will revelations that the French government is suing Volkswagen or whatever, will further revelations and further news flow prompt further falls in the stock? And it's just the problem with saying, oh, it's great buying opportunities, it's just, yeah, well, you can look back in hindsight and see, oh well, it would have been if you'd got in at the bottom, but you never know where the bottom is until it arrives.
Yeah, so I prefer things when they're coming back up.
Yeah.
But, you know, and there is a confirmed uptrend, but yeah, I mean, that would be my view on
yeah
on, in just, fact Carl, I'd stay clear of the automotive industry
if people want
for
to
for a while
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, we just don't know how far this could spread.
I think it might be worth, like, if people really do want to get speculative on it and buy into the story, I think they should explore ways to buy the debt, because I think it's fairly clear that VW isn't going to go under.
It has an awful lot of cash, from what I understand, a hell of a lot of cash.
And its owners are, you know, the lower state of Saxony is a massive owner. It's way too politically important in Germany to go under.
I read a note from Julius Baer this morning saying, from their fixed income guys, saying much the same thing. Good time to buy the debt.
And so if you're making that kind of binary call, is it going to survive? And you think, yes, it is going to survive, and that does seem like a pretty high probability. Then, and you don't want to take on the uncertainty surrounding, you know, these endless liabilities, then buying the debt, you know, is not a bad idea. But anyway, that's quite tricky. That's quite tricky.
You haven't convinced John there yet.
It's
a good suggestion, though, isn't it?
But it's quite a tricky thing for retail investors to do, rather annoyingly. So
I think so. You know,
I have to look into how they do that.
I would not be so sure that this doesn't mark the end of this company in the current form that it exists in.
Gosh,
wow,
bold call.
But it's bad stuff. This is bad stuff.
It is
huge. This is absolutely despicable.
It's deceit on a global scale.
It's absolutely despicable.
I think that point and about that global scale is quite important, because although BP, for example, you know, it was facing the most aggressive court system in the world in the US, at least it was only facing one.
Yeah, and the UK banks, you know, okay, so yeah, they right. have redress over in the US as well as in the UK, but we kind of knew sort of where yeah, the
well,
limits the,
well,
were.
Though LIBOR has a kind of global dimension, which is also quite worrying.
Yeah.
But BP was a one-off black swan event. It was a blow-up of a rig. This is something that was deliberately done to game
well,
the system.
Yeah, there's a deliberate thing too, but I mean, in terms of the environmental liabilities, is not dissimilar.
No, but reputationally, I think it's terrible.
Yeah, and that's another point, is that actually BP doesn't really have a consumer brand as such. I don't think people actually, I mean, it kind of does, but people aren't going to kind of avoid, even in the US, people weren't avoiding BP
gas stations.
you know, because go to the what's the Texaco one down the street just because it was BP, whereas actually with Volkswagen, when you've got there's a much wider range of brands, and it'd be very easy for people to simply to avoid VW.
There's a vast range of brands. I mean, you've got things like Seat, Skoda, and I looked at Seat, because their miles per gallon on their diesel people carriers were ridiculous. And now I know why. I'm not as confident that the repercussions for Volkswagen will not be life threatening for it. Mm. And I wanted to add, actually, that I found the idea that the chief executive, who didn't go for a while, it has to be said, he didn't fall on his sword immediately.
He waited for the EGM.
He claimed no knowledge of this. Now, you know,
and that he's not at fault at all.
Not at fault at all. I'm going to revert to my normal position on chief execs who oversee crises. If they don't know, they're incompetent. If they do know, they're criminals. And either way, they don't earn their money.
On the governance side, there's a very interesting story here, because I mean, probably UK stock pickers won't have been following what's been going on at VW, but it's actually, there's been a kind of interesting story brewing for a while, because their chairman resigned in May, basically over his opposition to Winterkorn. They had a kind of, it was completely unclear what the disagreement was about, but Martin Winterkorn basically won that debate, and so the chairman resigned, and they announced a couple of months ago that he would be replaced by the CFO, rather unusually stepping over the CEO to become the chairman. And at the time, people were thinking, oh, is it really good that another insider, you know, German companies are famous for promoting insiders and for this kind of like back-scratching corporate governance culture, of which this was a classic example. And the former chairman was the patriarch. He'd been there forever. The interesting question is, does the fact that Winterkorn has gone pave the way for the patriarch to return? Presumably it's going to be impossible to maintain this insiders get all the top jobs
now. Sounds messy.
Anyway, so there's a big there's an interesting management shake-up element
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't witness to it. I wasn't privy to what happened there. And in fact, I have read that there were criticisms of the lack of transparency in the way many German companies are actually run.
Well, exactly.
Which is quite interesting.
Yeah, and it, not least because of this issue where the CFO becomes the chairman. And, you know, in the UK, I mean, we criticise it in the UK too, where one city bigwig goes, you know, holds like two or three board positions, and it's all very kind of, it all seems like a kind of city club.
Yeah.
But in a way, that's better than this kind of very closed corporate culture where people don't go from one company to another that easily, and you get insiders promoted.
Yeah, that sounds.
Anyway, it sounds
messy.
Yeah.
And yeah, not the greatest corporate governance. And yeah, my views on management are not that warm anyway at times. So yeah, another disaster. Thank you very much. And that's going to cost a lot of people a lot of money. A lot of small shareholders will be caught up in this, as they were in the banks, as they were in you know, many other circumstances where management shortcomings, and you know, perhaps they'd taken their eye off the ball while they were power playing there at the board. Perhaps he didn't know because he was too busy playing power games,
fighting with the chairman.
Absurd. Is that enough? Another VW. I'm sure this is a story that is going to evolve.
It's going to go on and on and on, isn't it? I think for today, let's move on, shall we?
It makes me genuinely angry, as I'm sure.
That's why I want to move on. I'm getting worried so close to you.
Okay. What else have we got going on in the news?
Well, we could jump to the results.
On the car theme.
Well, let's keep to the car theme before we come back to the news. I'm not going to forget stuff this week, Bradley. So AA, because it's not been on the market for too long.
No, it only lifted last year.
But look at that graph. It's not been great.
No, it's basically back where it floated at. It sort of rose from about 300p to about 400 odd, and then it's come back. The shares fell on the news. I mean, the funny thing is basically that the reason the executive chairman Bob McKenzie thinks that the shares fell is because he put in this little rant about higher insurance premium tax,
right?
Which was a recent thing, and I think he sort of feels, as in his position heading the AA, has to stand up for the British motorist. So he put in this little kind of thing about high taxes in the way that Tim Martin at Wetherspoons always talks about pubs.
Did he say anything about emissions test gaming?
Well, this was before. This was end of last week. Anyway, I find it slightly unlikely that that's why the market sold off the shares, just because they basically, there was a lot of attention drawn to this issue of the insurance premium tax.
Doesn't seem to be growing very fast. Might be one accusation levelled at it, on a top line or bottom line.
Yes, which is actually quite surprising because people have been driving more because of the low petrol price.
We'll be back to that when I get up. Yeah.
But
spewing diesel emissions into the atmosphere.
As a non-car owner, I find it hard to share your anger, John. But I definitely
you forget. You're cycling. I mean, you cycle.
Yeah, no, I cycle.
You're breathing
in the
fumes. It's worse for you.
Absolutely. I do understand. I just don't have the visceral connection to cars.
As a member of the
millennial generation, you see, this isn't my product. But maybe we'll come on to that later.
All right. Yeah. Okay, so yes, why is AA not exactly flavour of the month at the moment?
It's had these higher garaging costs and it's had to up its advertising spending to get back in people's consciousness. I mean, I think one of basically when they came to market, they complained that they'd been, that their costs had been continually cut by their previous private equity owner, and basically they hadn't been able to invest in this revered British brand, and that the flotation paved the way for a recovery in their market position. And I think the reality, it is a good story. I think the reality is that motor insurance has become ever more competitive, and there's been a lot of churn. And the guy who wrote the story, Ian Smith, was saying that his dad's a classic example of a guy who'd always been with the AA, but actually he'd sort of decided to go elsewhere. You know, when he looked at a price comparison website online and saw what they were charging, and you know, there is that risk that the churn basically will undermine their customer base.
They upset me.
Oh gosh, we've got another anecdotal angle on stock picking.
I've broken down once in 5 or 6 years, and I've been a member of the AA for quite some time. actually joined when my car broke down previously, 5 or 6 years ago. And every year they'd renewed it automatically. And I broke down sometime last year. No, it was earlier this year. And I rang them up and they said, no, you're not a customer. And your membership has lapsed. I was like, what? So
they'd stopped renewing it.
They stopped renewing it. They stopped the auto renewal. They didn't send me a letter. They left me stranded up a hill in the middle of Essex. And luckily, my bank, through one of the packaged accounts, I realised I had green flag cover. So AA will never get my business ever again.
Well, this is a good example. Good example.
Yeah. Yes.
It's very easy to get cover. You know, exactly. It comes in so many different forms these days, and the price comparison websites make it all so transparent that, you know, that's the problem for AA, I think.
Yeah.
On the other hand, SNU, you know, we have AA on a whole, I should say, and SNU, which is next to it in the magazine, which does motor finance, is doing great guns because of this driving thing and also the, you know, easy credit market and so forth. So,
yeah, as we talked about this last week, within the general retail sector, cars have been doing especially well. And
but AA isn't the way to play it, I guess, is the conclusion of this little...
No, but I mean, looking through this again, it is the insurance side of things that's the problem there. And we talked about that too in recent weeks.
Admiral and Direct Line have all been suffering.
Tough rate environment there. Okay, I guess that's it from the car perspective. This week, should we quickly turn back to news, Bradley? And
I mean, I guess I'll probably keep this bit brief because we talk about China an awful lot. But there was manufacturing data out of China; it hit a 6.5-year low, according to Markets Cakes and Flash China General Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index.
But we would expect that because they're rebalancing their economy from
industrial base to
a consumer base.
Yeah, it does make sense, and hopefully the sort of it's a managed decline rather than just a free fall one. But it is still important data to note, and also it comes in a week when our Chancellor George Osborne was over in China as well, trying to sort of make sure that we're first in mind when China does have some money to spend.
He's a big fan of China, isn't he? I mean, we've got them involved now in Hinkley Point.
Well, yeah, which is actually again another bit of a segue into another story in news. We did mention Hinkley Point as well. So the government's basically launched this $2 billion loan guarantee. So it seems that China's kind of investing in the Hinkley Point project, and the government is effectively, I guess, guaranteeing that investment to a degree. I don't quite... The full details of it weren't particularly clear, but in effect, it kind of seems like George Osborne's travel over to China has resulted in a deal which... they've said, oh, please invest in it. The Chinese have, and the government have just probably said they'll back it, which I guess they're hoping the money won't be needed, I'm assuming.
Who knows?
I mean, if China is going to pay $2 billion, I'm sure it can afford that, and George Osborne's probably pretty certain of that, so it's easy for him to say, well, I'll guarantee it because I'm sure China will pay it.
Okay.
Perhaps, I'm just pontificating there.
He's also, I think this week, he's suggesting the Chinese invest in the high-speed rail links that are going up as well. So I think he knows where he wants the cash to come.
Yeah, I mean, China's economy might be slowing, but it still has a lot of money. And I think there is a bit of a scramble among, Western nations whose economies are kind of going the right direction, but slowly.
Yeah.
And I think, it's going to be important in a few years' time to be good friends with China and court their investments.
So. We already are. We also talk about China in the Apple piece in the new spotlight this week, because obviously what happens in China is very important for Apple. It's a big potential growth market for them.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we've kind of talked about Apple and China before. I think it was a few weeks ago. Apple came out and said, actually, in spite of the big market falls in China, we haven't seen, well, at the time, it hadn't seen its sales impacted. That was kind of talking about July and August trade. Now there's a bit more sort of focus on Apple because I think it's tomorrow, actually. It launches its 6S. I'm not an Apple person, so I don't really follow this as much as my colleague Theron, who's written the piece, does. New product out tomorrow, which obviously is key to the Apple story. I mean, it lives or dies by its new products, so that's one to watch. Obviously, although it is a US stock, I mean, we do cover Apple, and it's still on a long-term buy for us, but there are some UK companies which whose fortunes do kind of rest on how well Apple does, and those are listed in the article. They include Arm, which is a microchip designer. And so, yeah, there are kind of ways to play the Apple story with UK-based stocks if you don't want to buy Apple itself.
As we discussed last week, the retailers as well, Dixon's Carphone and Argos are all quite exposed to the tech product cycle, and I guess they'll be looking forward to a new device as well, given certainly Argos's recent trading for home retail.
Yeah, they'll be hoping it'll push their Christmas sales, I'm sure.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, while we're on the subject of Apple, we might as well move on to the cover feature because Apple is the must-have tool for the modern generation. And what we're talking about here is how essentially the generations that were born after mine and yours, Stephen? Well, are you still young enough to call yourself a millennial?
I was surprised to find that I am included in these.
Really?
This demographic label. Yeah, apparently people born after 1980, which only just includes me, are millennials.
So you're Generation Y.
Yeah, I'm Generation Y.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's great. Graham and I, we're much cooler than that. We're Generation X.
Generation X.
So anyway, so this is talking about, I think, what I'd hoped this feature did was kind of encourage people to think about how things are not static and how demographic changes really affect companies. Mm. So, you know, this is not the answer to demographics. It's certainly not a soup to nuts guide to the to Generation Y and Z. Mm. But I think it's really what I wanted it to do, as I said, was just to give a flavour of how things can change quite quickly over the course of a generation.
Right. And you only have to look at the makeup of the stock exchange a generation ago to realise that. This is something that Chris Dillow often writes about, right? That he thinks you want to back the field, not the horse, because the horses change. And although, however impregnable some company looks now, Volkswagen, say,
Apple,
Apple, indeed, yeah, Facebook, whatever. Google is the obvious example. It was only founded in 2001.
Yep,
which is utterly extraordinary. I always find and. Well, let's not forget the iPhone was only launched in 2007.
Or Facebook. I mean, Facebook for me is an amazing example of a company that literally came out of nowhere. And it's basically the kind of fabric by which many sort of new communities, not the old ones that we might know about, not the village, the village hall or the parish council.
The board of governors at the school.
the online communities that a lot of people now live in. I mean, that is their life now for a lot of people. And it's that change of behaviour has happened in a decade.
Exactly. So I guess you only have to look at a generation ago what the makeup of the stock exchange to realise that in a generation it's going to be different again. And how do you begin to think about that? Well, obviously it's highly speculative because the future is highly uncertain. But one way to think about it, I guess, is in terms of demographics and what the taste of the people who are now teenagers is. And that's what this feature is about.
Yeah.
And we're focusing on three sectors. There's technology, and our tech guy, who's certainly a millennial himself, and I think he's one of our youngest members of the company's team.
Yeah, we always should have a young guy covering tech.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jonas, who's one of the more senior members of the...
always have a senior guy covering property.
is writing the property angle, which is quite an interesting one because one of the obviously buy-to-let landlords have been major beneficiaries of the fact that the younger generation can't afford to, and in many cases are happy not to get on the housing ladder in their 20s and sometimes early 30s in favour of renting much longer. So you actually have quite affluent people, of professionals often in the private rented sector.
Yeah, well, we spoke about this sort of offline, as it were. But the general story, the kind of rhetoric out there is that the current generation are being dealt a terrible blow by not being able to get onto the housing ladder in the way that our parents' generation was, and even to an extent ours. Perhaps not quite as cheaply or easily, but we weren't excluded altogether. Whereas future generations, those sort of approaching that age where they want to get into housing now, just simply can't afford to do it in the areas they want to do it. And this the theme is that this is something that's been thrust upon them, renting, and that it's a terrible thing. But actually, there are other aspects to it that I thought were quite interesting, that this is perhaps also, there's an element of choice in it.
Yeah, I think there's an element of choice. I mean, funnily enough, surveys still suggest that everyone wants to buy a house or home in the end. At the same time, people like the freedom to work abroad in their early years. The fact that Britain's member of the European Union, we have a single market for labour, means that people kind of travel around more than they used to and work abroad a bit more than they used to. And urban living, people want to go to London and experience that kind of lifestyle, often four people crammed into a four-bedroom house rather than, you know, four single people or couples or whatever.
It's like, hutching.
Yeah. You know, it's just, it's a, anyway, it's just a different kind of, yeah, it's a different model, and it does mean that people often end up seemingly buying property later, well, though it's a bit unclear what the current, you know, the people in their 20s now, what they're going to do, because...
Live at home. And I don't ever expect to get rid of my children, which is why I'm building them an annex in the loft. No, I mean, this is interesting. So actually, it suggests that the whole clamour for more homes to buy is perhaps wider than mark. What we perhaps need is more
rental homes,
more rental property, affordable rental property.
Yeah, well,
and that suggests institutional involvement, really.
Yes, I mean, well, that's something that we've written about a certain amount. You know, the institutional buy-to-let model. I mean, this is sort of going beyond the scope of this feature. But I mean, actually, I think there's another element to this feature which ties into this, which is quite interesting, which is that because people are used to living in bedrooms, because housing costs have become so high, people are used to living in bedrooms or one in a studio sort of kind of arrangements. They don't have as much space for stuff like books or DVDs or CDs. And I think that's one of the drivers, not the only driver, one of the drivers behind another trend which we're looking at here, which is the popularity of renting stuff rather than buying it.
Yeah, so basically the end of ownership.
Yeah, the end of ownership. So although people still aspire to own a home, the fact that if they do get one, then it's likely to be quite small, and many won't, and will simply live in quite temporary arrangements with friends, moving around a certain amount means they just don't want to own all the stuff. I mean, they don't want to kind of move from North to South London, you know, three times in 5 years with their entire record LP collection the way that, you know, my father's generation.
Well, your father has 100 records.
He has many, but I yes, that's a loose estimate.
I think you've done him a disservice. There,
probably.
I don't count that as a collection. I think I've got 2,500. I moved house in March and the movers were not very impressed when they saw
that's before they even got
to the books.
But this is just it, you know. But if you had a Kindle, if it were all electronic, then this wouldn't be such a headache. And I think, you know, I after I graduated from university, I moved abroad for a few years, and that was one of the main reasons why I sort of ended up giving up on my CD collection, because I just couldn't carry it everywhere.
Yeah, I love stuff. I'm so Generation X. No, it is fascinating. So I mean, we've seen, you know, over the course of the last few years, a couple of companies succumb to these trends.
HMV
being the obvious example. But yeah, I mean, they couldn't move quick. I mean, partly that was because Amazon came along and really kind of ate their lunch. But also because, you say, people are buying less stuff. Waterstones.
Game Digital.
They're Game Digital, yeah.
I mean, they've come back as Game Digital, but they had to go bust as Game.
That's true.
Whatever it was.
That's true. Over expansion of their physical estate, that was. And also a downturn in the console cycle. A number of trends coming to a head. And I guess this whole Generation Z thing, as we've called the cover feature, is about the coming together of a number of trends, sort of financial pressures and technological progress coming together to enable this generation to behave in a different way.
But it is worth, you know, stressing that given that the iPhone was only launched in 2007, we're calling this the gateway millennial device. Who knows what, you know, the next few years will bring in terms of innovation, which could change the picture completely. I think the point is to remain very open-minded about what you consider to be a long-term holding.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think Apple, so the rumours would suggest, is working on a car at the moment. So
an electric car, no problem with emissions there.
What better time to disrupt the automotive? Motive,
well, they might tell you it's electric, but
yeah, it's actually got a huge V12 engine in the back. So I mean, and that could change things as well. And I've actually, going back to cars, I've seen there's a great analyst note, and I can't remember who wrote it. I'm doing a massive disservice by not being able to name check him, but it's the same principle. It's the change in the structure of ownership of vehicles. Mm. You know, we still operate in the automotive sector the same model we've had since Henry Ford, which is car is made, we buy car, we sell car.
But the purchase these days is more like a kind of...
It can be a higher purchase.
It's a higher purchase for 3 years often. You return it.
Yeah. You're seeing things like carpooling. You're seeing, you know, the zip car type trends. Yeah. So that model is changing as well. And I think what this analyst concluded was the automotive space is one of the biggest industries ripe for some massive disruption.
Yeah.
In the same way that music has been disrupted, for example. So, yeah, we haven't written about cars here. I wish we had now. It would have been perfect.
Maybe we can do another.
Yeah. And of course, there's the leisure and retail trend, I think.
Right, and online often. So that has... But I think, you know, people are familiar with the idea that retail is in this change. The challenges are, I think, not terribly well understood still, and they haven't found the solution, and it's still very much a moving feast.
Yeah.
And that means that there are still lots of costs to be sunk through IT investment and so forth. Don't think that just because the tech bubble burst 14 years ago that they've found any solutions yet.
No.
It's amazing, isn't it?
No. But I mean, someone like Primark, for example, is a good example of a company that really captured the
zeitgeist.
The imagination, the zeitgeist, that what the young consumer actually wanted. That was stuff, cheap, lots, throw away, buy more, which is quite... I find that as equally distressing as pumping diesel pollution into the air. But that seems to be the way the world is going. You know, the tailored suit that you keep for a lifetime is a thing of the past.
Yeah, just buy another one from Primark.
That's right. What is even more depressing is the fact that young people avoid the pub. But I guess the upside is that leaves it empty for me. speaking of which, Brandon, you've done the Sex Focus this week on the hospitality industry and the impact of the living wage.
So yeah, on the subject of pubs, obviously, which is a big part of the hospitality sector, the Resolution Foundation did a great report, and it showed that 46% of all those affected, which is equivalent to 2.7 million people, work in just three industries, one of which is hospitality. And potentially even worse for hospitality, nearly every second employee, so 48% of people, will be impacted. And this is quite a big impact because the National Living Wage it kicks off in April. It starts at £7.20, and the government is hoping to reach, I think it's £9.35 by 2020. So there's potentially a big cost there for these types of companies who very often do employ, you know, a younger generation. Tim Martin over at Wetherspoons, who we've sort of kind of mentioned earlier in this podcast.
You've mentioned him every week for the past few weeks.
He just says some good stuff, you know. So he in the recent results said that pub wages are equal to 30% of sales. So obviously, if wages are going to rise for pubs, that could be a significant impact. Obviously, JD Wetherspoon does focus on selling things low cost, so you could argue the impact on JD Wetherspoons could be greater than other pubs that sell a more expensive pint. But yeah, it's one for investors to watch out for. Companies like Restaurant Group, they kind of predict the first year's cost will be about £2 million for them, which isn't too much for a group that size. Part of that is because they employ a lot of skilled kitchen staff who are already paid above this National Living Wage level. So yeah, it's important to kind of keep an eye on the pub restaurant stocks. Have a look at the Sector Focus. We've named a couple of favourites and a couple of outsiders, and there are some potentially supportive trends. Obviously, while wages are going up, you know, inflation is quite benign, so food costs, if you're a pub that sells food, are quite low. And also corporation tax, you know, George Osborne is doing the companies a favour there by reducing it. But yeah, I think that the rise in wages probably does, you know, outweigh the reduction in corporation tax. So yeah, it's one for investors to be careful about. And please check out the Resolution Foundation report as well. We've got an expert view from one of the co-authors of it, Connor D'Arcy. So be good to read his views.
Okay. Well, hopefully it'll put a few more quid in the pockets of the young people. And maybe they can afford to get on the housing ladder one day if they want to. Okay, thank you, Bradley. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Graham, for your views today. Plenty of interesting stuff in the magazine beyond Volkswagen and beyond the cover feature. Algy Hall is back with another stock screen, High Yield Free Cash Flow Kings, another corking screen that's been delivering great returns since it's been run. More in the news section. We've got some more fallout from the falling oil price in the engineering sector. Stephen's taken a look at the very unsurprising decision not to raise interest rates over in the US in taking stock. Usual tips, results in the magazine this week, and obviously plenty in the personal finance and fund section, which they will be talking about on their podcast tomorrow. So, yeah, Well, I'm sure next week won't be as exciting, but we always say that. Thank you very much for listening. You pick up the magazine in all good news agents, £4.50, and we'll chat again next week. See you later. Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.